This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, welcome everyone. Great to see you here. Full crowd, blazing lights. Hope those might go down a little bit, just to save our friends here. Oh, look at that. If only I was listened to in other aspects of the museum's practice like that. Is that terrible to complain? On this great night, when we're joined by guests and our great friends from the ABC for what's going to be a fascinating panel, I think, tonight, panel discussion, can I begin by welcoming everyone and thanking you for joining us tonight. For those of you that don't know me, my name's Matt Trenker. I'm the Director of the National Museum of Australia. I want to begin, as always here at the National Museum, by acknowledging that we meet on the lands of the Ngunnawal, Ngunnawal, Ngambri peoples, who've been here for a very long time, and offer my respects, my thanks for the continuing welcome we receive from these communities of this place. And as I frequently say here at events at the National Museum, I think it's one of the great virtues of living in this country that we live in a place that has such a long human history. And for those of us who hail originally from other places, which is a very great many of us, to be mixing our story now with the stories of those people who've been here for countless millennia is a very special thing indeed. So I extend that respect that I've offered to the people of this place, to all the First Nations of this continent, and thank them for the continuing welcome that we receive in this country. This is quite a discussion tonight about how protest and an enthusiasm for change, for reform, has played such a part in making Australia, and indeed we'll canvass how forms of protest have really evolved and consider how the role of protest perhaps changed in Australian society over the course of at least the recent past. History shows us that protests have been a feature of Australian life for a very long time, that ranges really across the political spectrum, representing the interests, I think, of people of all walks of life and from very different parts of a political frame and representing a series of political views. And we speak often about the defining moment in this place, the defining moment of Eureka in 1854, that rebellion in Ballarat when gold miners demanded reforms to the system of licensing, mining license fees there. And before and after, protest has been a signal part of Australian life. I think of the women's suffrage movement, the World War I conscription debates, the great protests and political action that have sought justice for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in this country, not least the Day of Mourning in 1938 and the 1966 Wave Hill walk-off, the Razorback truckers blockade of 1979. Anyone remember that? The fight to save the Franklin River, of course, the airline pilots dispute of 1989, and farmers' rallies in Canberra. So it has indeed been something that's ranged across a breadth of political view, and the desire to make one's views known and heard, I think, has been an important feature of Australian life. And so when, in the National Museum's Defining Moments in Australian History project, our great project online and through these sorts of events such as we're holding tonight, when we came to consider the role of protest and political action has played in the life of our nation, we have seen that there are a great many defining moments, if you like, that have some of this spirit in them. And indeed, our collection, the National Historical Collection, includes key objects from Eureka, the Vietnam War, the Wave Hill walk-off, many other protests, and that, of course, that surrounded the Franklin, the fight for the Franklin. And the latter, thanks greatly to Dr. Bob Brown, who's with us tonight. Thank you, Bob, for returning to this place. We're the proud holders of the Bob Brown collection. I take this opportunity to thank him for the great faith he showed in gifting that collection to the nation, of course, with us as its custodians. So taking that as our line and with an expectation of the territory we might roam across tonight, a big welcome to the aforementioned environmentalist, doctor, former Australian Greens leader, Dr. Bob Brown, to Pat Turner, a highly experienced policymaker and current CEO of the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, to Adjunct Professor of Politics, Honorary Professorial Fellow at the University of Melbourne, Dr. Verity Bergman, and author and highly acclaimed diplomatic and military historian, Dr. Peter Edwards. Welcome to you all, and thank you for joining us tonight. And of course, a very big welcome to our great friend. I was just talking to him before about how much we missed him when he took 6 months sabbatical, and I thought it was this year, but it was last year. How time flies. Great to see you, Paul, tonight. Paul Barclay, of course, Walkley Award-winning journalist and broadcaster from the Big Ideas program. It's an honour to host you all here tonight. And now, over to you, Paul.
Yeah, thanks very much, Matt. It's always great to be back here at the National Museum of Australia, and especially to host the latest instalment in our Defining Moments in Australian History series. The discussion that I'm about to host is being recorded for Big Ideas on RN, and it will appear in the weeks to come. Probably, I was just saying to the guests, probably not till early next year, so keep an ear out for that. You can also follow me on Twitter at Paul Barclay and get an idea of what's coming up on Big Ideas. Let me also acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which we meet today and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. It's no exaggeration to say that the Australia of today has been shaped by the social and political protests of yesterday. Australian suffragettes marched in the streets for the right to vote for women. Charlie Perkins and his Freedom Riders drew attention to racism and discrimination faced by Indigenous Australians. Hundreds of thousands of ordinary citizens took to the streets to demand an end to conscription and an end to the Vietnam War. Environmentalists formed a blockade to save the Franklin River in Tasmania. The first gay Mardi Gras marches paved the way for LGBTIQ rights, including later on marriage equality. There are so many more examples I could draw on. Social and political progress rarely occurs without organised campaigning and disruption, without a struggle. And even in this era of online activism, we're still taking to the streets. Extinction Rebellion protesters using civil disobedience to demand urgent action to tackle the climate change emergency. Change does not come easy. Many protests fall on deaf ears. In 2003, hundreds of thousands of you marched in the streets of Australia against Australia's involvement in the Iraq War. These were some of the biggest protests in Australian history. Hundreds of thousands. Bob was just telling me before that you could look down from the State Library of Victoria all the way down Swanston Street to Flinders Street Station, and all you could see were people, ordinary people, many of them who hadn't marched for years, protesting against Australia's involvement in that war, yet we still went to war. Tonight's speakers will cast an eye over our rebellious past and consider the future of popular protest. They've been introduced by Matt, but perhaps I should just present the order of our speakers. We have a Verity from left to right. We have a Verity Bergman, Bob Brown, Pat Anderson, and at the end, Peter Edwards. Pat Turner. Excuse me, Pat, I'm terribly sorry. Please make them welcome. Bob, you've protested so many times, you've been arrested several times, thrown in jail. I thought I'd begin by asking you, what's the most memorable protest that you've attended and been a part of?
If I can crib on two, one was I was in the Styx Forest, the tallest trees, flowering trees on earth, just yesterday with environmental prize winners for our foundation in central Tasmania, and it took 4,000 people. We thought hundreds would turn up to a Wilderness Society protest there in 2004 with snow on the ground in the morning, and instead of that, 4,000 people turned up in the most remote environmental protest of that variety in Tasmanian history. But I think the most memorable one is being under some cutting grass just over the Picton Bridge in the East Picton Forest in Tasmania in 1987, when there was an explosion up on the hill, and we had a bus blockading a logging road there. That was blown up, and then down the road came a carload of people with guns out the window and a hunting dog, and I'd said to the other protesters, run deep into the forest, and I got under this cutting grass, and the searchlight came around, and the dog was whining, and afterwards, they didn't see me, or I'd be dead now. Afterwards, they went back across the bridge and with gelignite blew up the cars that were there, and they'd burnt the forest. And it was fairly well known who those people were, but they weren't arraigned.
Wow.
And that forest, what's left of it, the forest we were protecting then with all the wildlife was destroyed, but the Picton Valley, what's left of it, like the Styx, is now in World Heritage because of protesters.
How many times have you been arrested, Bob, over the years? Have you lost count?
I think eight, but I nine if you count my father, who was a policeman locking me up when I was six for not eating for not eating my spinach. But you know, when I came out, that was cruel and unusual because he made my it was cold by then, and he made me eat the spinach, but my mother made up for it with some sweets. Look, you don't get arrested for nothing, but the environment of the planet's in dire peril. We all know that, and taking peaceful action against wrong law. Gandhi said that there's only one thing worse than wrong laws, and that's their implementation. And we're seeing harsher implementation of existing laws, but new laws coming in. And so what we've seen to date is just a little light on what we're going to see in the decades ahead right around the planet.
Yeah, we'll talk about some of the threats to the right to protest during this discussion. Pat, you've been also to numerous protests over the years. What are some of the memorable, maybe the memorable one or two protests that you'd like to mention?
Well, I think the first one was the first land rights march that we organised in Alice Springs, where I was born, of course. And so my uncle, Charles Perkins, was home on, I don't know what they called it, whether they sacked him or they put him on leave for a year or whatever it was. And so he was home in Alice, and myself and three other young, we were young in those days, young people in the mid-70s organised the first land rights march in Alice Springs. So we had a barbecue in the Todd River.
Sorry, when was this? Which year was this?
I think it was about 1975. And Alice Springs, you know, never seen anything like this. So we'd done all the banners up and, you know, had to get everyone there, so we put on a breakfast, sausage breakfast. And so we got a really good crowd and we marched down the streets of Alice Springs with our land rights placards. So that was very memorable because it was the first one in Alice, and of course many more followed. But also the one of the most memorable was the 1988 protest in Sydney. And I was actually in Townsville that year to oversee the arrangements for the fifth Festival of Pacific Arts, where we had a couple of thousand Indigenous people from around the Pacific come to Townsville to celebrate and promote the Indigenous cultures of the Pacific for a couple of weeks, which happened in August later that year. So I went to Sydney for the protest. It was enormous. Mm. And, you know, why they think that we weren't going to do anything, I have no idea. Because, of course, we were far from having the social justice thing, but it was a wonderful occasion.
Ended up at Hyde Park, a number of speakers.
Oh, yeah. We had, you know, we had everybody there. Mm. We had people had travelled for days and days, and driving in buses from the Territory and from WA and Queensland. And, you know, so there were, I don't know how many of us there, but a big mob, we say.
It was a big mob. Yeah. And Verity, what about you? You've been involved in a range of social and political movements over the years. What sticks out to you?
Well, I suppose the first time one is arrested always sticks out in one's mind. And in my case, this was in 1971. This was the year that the anti-apartheid movement was organising protests at the matches of the racially selected Springboks rugby team from South Africa. And in the case of the, I think it was the first test at the SCG, I was one of a group of four who managed to leap over the picket fence of the members' stand and run into the middle of the ground. I got there first, being 18 and fleet-footed at the time, and I kicked the ball out of the scrum.
Wow.
Good idea. Yep.
There'd be footage of that, would there? Television footage
of
that?
Yes, there is footage of it. And in fact, Canadian friends tell me that it's something that is often played on Canadian television for some reason, more often than on here. Yes, but I was arrested and charged with offensive behaviour. So was my sister Meredith, and in fact, she was got a 3-month jail sentence with hard labour. That was overturned on appeal, turned into a suspended sentence. So that was obviously memorable. But with the benefit of hindsight, I think I'd like also to mention that I was on the very first Mardi Gras march in 1978. And I'd never imagined then, as you know, people were being beaten up by the police and it was such a siege, hostile atmosphere that a few decades later, 40 years later, we would have our marriage equality. Mm. So that has been an extraordinary example of a very, very beleaguered movement achieving an extraordinary amount.
Yes, indeed. Should also say, actually, that Verity was once arrested for hitting a police officer with a paper mache truncheon. They took that rather seriously. Perhaps we'll come back to that if we have time later on. Now, Peter, you're a historian, so I suppose you have a kind of more scholarly interest in protest and what goes on at demonstrations. You're an observer. Have you ever been a participant, though, in a protest?
Not of the sort that you mentioned, but if you look at page 7 of the Canberra Times this morning, you'll see I make the occasional protest with the pen. Mm-hmm. But it's mostly been an observer, but I have been thrown out of the odd protest march, actually, because in 1968, the year of revolutions all around the world, I was a graduate student in England, and I got a student newspaper to give me a press pass to a presidential convention. So the only presidential nominating convention I've ever been to was the 1968 convention in Chicago. The
wow.
Democratic one, which ended in which became a police riot.
Yes.
And walking around the streets of Chicago after that was a chilling experience. Seeing the, I remember just walking around a corner once, and there were these trucks of the National Guard, all loaded up, looking, you know, military style trucks. And you know, you had the sense that the country was almost on the verge of civil war.
That the so-called siege of Chicago, didn't Norman Mailer write a book about that?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I only saw a certain amount of it because I was where the same place as the delegates to the convention were, which was in the convention hall some way away from downtown. But, there was another rally where I was thrown out from Senator Eugene McCarthy was having a meeting. And the marshals came up and thought I looked too suspicious and too foreign, so they ejected me.
I'm interested in, and we can mention as we will, what makes a successful protest? I mean, you have on the one hand the numbers of people that get out into the streets, and that doesn't necessarily mean the protest will deliver its outcome, though. I thought I'd ask you this, Bob. Do protests shift societal attitudes Is that what makes them successful, or do they respond to changes in how we're already thinking about certain issues, like, for example, the environment?
I think they're both those things. As Verity was talking about, the protests against the Springbok tour, and that had a huge impact on changing the Australian feeling, because sport was at the centre of this, and here were people disrupting a huge sporting event to protest against racism and apartheid, and I think that had stopped millions of Australians to think about this and had a big impact on the future Australian opposition to apartheid and eventually the end of it in as far as Australia could influence it in South Africa. But I think the big thing is heart. If your heart is in what you're protesting for, then it's much more likely to succeed. And in a functioning democracy, the aim of protest is to change, is to do exactly that, is to change the mind of the public. We knew with the Franklin campaign that this little part of Australia with the last great wild river in southern Australia needed to get to the public. And so protests, which culminated in 20,000 people in the streets of Hobart and 15,000 in Melbourne with Bob Hawke up saying, "I will stop the dam," and the run to the 1983 election were hugely important, but there've been 7 years in getting films out, in distributing literature, in getting people to understand what an important part of the national and Australian heritage. And when the Indigenous people took a stand for their country in, I think that was absolutely critical to saving the Franklin, it became a test of heart, and the voters, millions of voters in Australia, had the decision in 1983. It's one of those, maybe the most outstanding case of an environmental issue, an issue about what sort of Australia are we going to have in the future, that changed that vote and brought Bob Hawke and Labor into power, and at the expense of losing every seat in Tasmania. But it took gumption from that leader.
Yeah.
To say, "I will stop the dams," with Hazel standing next to him with her no dams earrings on in front of the crowd in Melbourne, that saved the river, which is now one of the recognised as one of the world's great whitewater rafting adventures.
I think of a couple of things when I think of that campaign. I think the over 40% of people who on the ballot papers for the Flinders by-election in Victoria, very much a middle Australia electorate, wrote "no dams" on their ballot paper.
And then here in the ACT.
And here as well, yeah. And I also think, and I don't think you can underplay this, the wonderful photographs of Peter Dombrovskis that brought to light just exactly what was at stake in that campaign.
Just pivotal. That picture is better than 1,000 words, but Peter's pictures were so fundamental to saying in a one pager or a one TV ad, here's what is at stake here.
Verity, I'm interested in, to a lot of protest movements when they first start, emerge from the radical fringes of protest groups pushing for issues that don't have majority public support at first. What role and what can the radical groups claim in terms of the success of some of the big political movements in Australia, the moratorium marches, for example? How much is it about them, and how much is it about the moderates who then basically embrace those issues?
Well, political scientists like to talk about what they call the radical flank effect. And the argument basically is that when reforms are achieved, it's often because the movement has demanded a lot more than the reforms that are attained. So, for example, the Femocrats of the women's movement in the 1970s and so on, who achieved a lot, were offered places in the corridors of power, to a large extent because of the strength of the much more outrageous women's liberation movement on the ground. Going back further, you could argue that the defeat of the referenda around conscription during the Great War in 1916 and 1917 were achieved because there was a very vigorous movement that didn't just oppose conscription, but also opposed involvement in the war, who argued that this was a nasty imperialist war that the plutocrats were benefiting from, and working class people were sent off to the front and their lives wasted. And so the anti-conscription, pure and simples as they were called, emerged as the voice of compromise and reason that could get majority support. And so the referenda for conscription were defeated because the anti-conscriptionists were seen as the middle ground.
Yeah.
They're just a couple of examples of the radical flank effect.
Yeah, we'll talk more about both of those because they're some of the most important political movements in our history, the anti-war and anti-conscription movements. Pat, so many of the protests involving Indigenous Australians around land rights, around constitutional rights and so on, have not achieved what was hoped for, but tell us about how important these collective protests have been, not just for what you're trying to achieve, but for bringing your community together as a uniting force.
Yeah. Well, extremely important. When you're 3% of the population, you're this mouse with the elephant in the majority. So we have chosen to kick up and make our voices heard, not listened to very well by governments at all. Nevertheless, one of the things that I've found with our protests is that it gives us a chance to catch up with each other and see how we're going. So it's a very unifying thing for us. Catching up with old mates you haven't seen since the last protest or for a long time, to be serious. It's a very important part, I think, of the impact of us getting together and making our voices heard about whatever the issues are.
It gives you strength because a lot of the issues that you're campaigning for, you've been campaigning for a long time.
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's nothing new in what's being sought. And it's hard, but we keep on keeping on because we have to, So I think that we have achieved some good things, but we have a long, long way to go.
Yeah. Peter, I've heard it said by the baby boomers that the hippies may be much maligned, but they helped to stop an unpopular war. The anti-Vietnam moratorium marches in Australia back in 1970 were the biggest public demonstrations up until that time there, writ large in Australian history. Did people power end the war and bring the troops home?
Only to a certain extent. I think the war was ended because it was unwinnable in the first place. And so it had already been on for, well, Australians had been committed for 5 years by the time of the moratorium marches. And American opinion was turning against the war. And the real battle in the Vietnam War was for American public opinion. It wasn't even in Vietnam itself. So once American public opinion was turning, that really took Australia with it. But I think the Vietnam protests in Australia had a much wider effect in that they came as an awful shock to the establishment, to most middle-class Australians, the quiet Australians or the middle ground or whatever you want to call them. And this was a pretty new phenomenon because memories of the conscription referenda and so on were long gone. But people learned that you could protest, and there was this cumulative effect, and we can argue about which came first, but it coincided with the women's movement, the gay liberation movement,
You're saying it didn't stop the war, but it did inarguably end conscription, those marches.
Yeah. And conscription was always the hot button issue. I think the movement was much more emotion, certainly, was generated by the anti-conscription sense than by Vietnam per se. And that touched on a very old chord. I mean, it goes back to the original compromise made in the 1903 Defence Act, which was that you could conscript people for compulsory military service within Australia, but only volunteers would go overseas. Mm. And when Billy Hughes tried to challenge that in 1916-17, it provoked that huge reaction. John Curtin got into trouble in the Second War for a very modest extension of it. And when Menzies tried to bring in conscription in the 60s, which wasn't actually for Vietnam, people were much more concerned about Indonesia at the time than Vietnam. But that was the trigger, if you like.
They were a motley crew of protesters. You had the anti-American imperialists, you had the hippies, but you also had the mums and dads from the suburbs concerned about the fate of their kids. How important was it for the protesters to maintain a degree of unity, given that there were all of these disparate groups, many of whom wouldn't necessarily agree about a whole lot of things, but on this issue, they certainly did come together?
Well, that's the important thing, I think, about any protest movement. And Bob says that you've got to have your heart in it. But protests are successful partly by the emotion generated from the heart, but partly by the canniness in the head. And, you know, getting those two together is not always easy. The anti-Vietnam protests, there were two quite distinct strands. The more moderates who basically said the war's unwinnable, and the more radical ones who wanted to overturn all sorts of institutions. And it was not easy to keep them all together. And I think Jim Cairn's finest hour was in that first moratorium movement, when he made sure that those two wings stayed together, that there was no outrageous radical action. And that's what made a great impression on public opinion at that time.
Verity, is that accord with your view?
Well, just a couple of comments. Firstly, I don't think that divisions within a protest movement are necessarily a problem. I think often divisions can be quite productive. Certainly the radical flank effect works best if there is also a very, very strong moderate wing of a movement that can even, if it likes, declaim and denounce the radicals. Certainly in the case of anti-Vietnam mobilisations, the moderates were very quick to denounce the Monash University Labour Club students, who didn't just oppose the war, they went and collected money for the National Liberation Front. So that was an example of them being totally outrageous in their activities, in a way making the merely, oh, we shouldn't be there position look like the voice of compromise and reason.
It's curious to find out, Bob, that you were a doctor working in Canberra helping young men avoid the draft by certifying that those who didn't want to fight in Vietnam were unfit to be conscripted. Tell us about that, and were there many other doctors taking such action? Was such action ethical, in fact, as a doctor?
Well, you have the Hippocratic oath, don't you, to do the best by the person who's come to get your services. Right on this spot was the Canberra Community Hospital, and the senior registrars at the hospital had failed everybody who was brought up for Vietnam service. So they sacked all them and brought us junior resident doctors up to re-examine the lot. And I was changing at this stage. I've been very conservative. People like Verity were changing my mind. But when it came to, I missed the first draft by 4 days myself. I was too old. But here were people who came up for examination who'd just were appalled by going to Vietnam. There are others who wanted to go. So it was a case of saying to the people who were appalled, look, I think you've got a little bit of acne. This is a bit of a worry in the tropics. Go home, have no cream, don't eat citrus fruit, don't have any showers, eat this and that, come back next week. And inevitably you had to fail them the next week. And the other one was you don't have any homosexual tendencies, do you? That is prohibited in the armed services. So quite a few got failed on that score as well. and by the way, if you wanted to go to Vietnam, because we had to, we realised that they'd re-examine again. That if you had flat feet but you wanted to go to Vietnam, well, we could do some foot exercises that would make it acceptable. Yeah. Terrible dilemma.
Pat, we all know about the famous Wave Hill walk-off by the Gurindji led by Vincent Lingiari in 1966. That led to the first land rights legislation. But long before that, in 1939, there was the Kumaragunja, have I got that right?
Kumaragunja.
Walk-off. Perhaps, I understand, the first ever mass strike by Aboriginal people.
Yes, well, there were quite a lot of... there's a lot of activism by the Aboriginal Progress Association, which started in the 1920s. And so there were some, you know, magnificent people, Aboriginal people, who were leading that. So we had the Kumaragunja walk-off, and people were protesting about wages and the restrictions on them. There was also the 1938 Day of Mourning in Sydney, led by, with the same people involved, where they called for citizenship. And that was on the 150th anniversary, of course, of the colonisation of our country. And it was a really simple ask, you know. The other thing that was happening, of course, at the time was the Aboriginal reserve lands were being whittled away by the government and the settlers who wanted to, you know, have it, I suppose. And so our people were very concerned about those measures that were occurring. So they were very active, very active. And, of course, there were all the resistance like Jundamara in the Kimberley, who fought off and kept the troopers at bay for years. You know, and I've been to Jundamara's country and I've been shown by his ancestors exactly, you know, where he, how he traversed that terrain and how he was so clever in that resistance. And, of course... there was an article today in The Guardian about the killing times and the map of the massacres. So, you know, I don't want to get away from it, but our people have resisted from day one, and the impact of colonisation is still with us large and loud and clear. And but now we're a minority in our own country.
Yeah, and no, I think those earlier protests deserve to be better known than they are. I mean, I think many people obviously know about the Aboriginal Tent Embassy and the Freedom Rides and some of the later protests that have been covered more extensive in the history books, but you're very right to point out that the protests began fairly soon after colonisation.
That's the day one.
Great protest in Australian history, and of course it's ongoing. But the minority is, I think, gaining a great deal more strength from the majority, which feels we can't go along with this wrong longer. We've got to take action against it.
I think that also with protests, we've learnt that you have to have a strategy. You can't do it, you know, just go out on the street and make a noise and go home and feel good about it. You really have to have a plan. And so I think where we've been most successful is where we have had a strategy that is ongoing to influence people. We are getting better at social media campaigning.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm not good at it personally. I'm a bit of a, you know, what do you call it, idiot on that sort of stuff. But my three-year-old grandson's, you know, getting across it very quick smart.
he is the future, no doubt.
Yes, that's right. But anyway, I just wanted to make the point that it's important to have a strategy around it.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what, you know, the radical fringe and the in the middle groups, that's how it sort of transpired.
Mm.
With us, you know, I think that we've known that for some time.
Mm.
And you know, I am feeling a sense of hope from the Australian people. And we are appealing more to the Australian people because you're the people who vote. We don't have the numbers to change governments, but we certainly have a lot of issues which we would like your support on to make sure we get the right government. And ultimately, that's the ultimate power that you have living in a country like this. And of course, we didn't get that power until the 60s, 1960s.
Mm.
Mm.
Bob, you successfully challenged the anti-protest laws that Tasmania introduced last year in the High Court. These laws were seen as being in breach of the implied right to political free speech in the Constitution. Notwithstanding that victory, would it be fair to say that we are seeing the right to protest coming under greater threat in Australia today?
Absolutely, and just in the last few days, the Hodgman government in Tasmania has brought in even more draconian penalties. The Minister for so-called resource development has cooed that it'll be 21 years in jail for environmentalists, 18 months in jail plus $10,000 for a first offence of standing peacefully in the way of chainsaws coming to destroy a 1,000-year-old tree full of wildlife on Indigenous territory. And 4 years next time up, but up to 21 years, and that legislation is now extended to cover fish farms. Tassal was at the one of the big fish farmings to stop people protesting about the degradation of the oceans around Tasmania as well as on shore. And what we're seeing here, parallel with the federal government's move to stop secondary boycotts, is protest coming from the plutocracy that Verity spoke about, the rich corporations, through weak spine governments against the people. They're protesting against the people by bringing in draconian laws. They know they can't win the argument, so they've got to lock up those people who are espousing that argument. And unless we stand against that and vote out people who do that, we're in for a period of repression in Australia that the non-Indigenous people haven't seen in a long, long time.
Well, Verity, we just saw the Queensland Labor government actually pass some laws that crack down on climate change protesters who use locking devices. This obviously in a state that's had a history of protest being outlawed under Joe Bjelke-Petersen. Bob's mentioned the proposed legislation in Tasmania. I mean, is this a phenomenon Australia-wide? I mean, are we seeing governments of all persuasions seemingly wanting to crack down on this?
It's not just an Australian phenomenon, it's a worldwide phenomenon. And I think the irony should never be lost on us that with several decades of the dominance of free market ideas and practices, we see the neoliberal strong state very heavy-handedly dealing with the consequences to a large extent of those of free market forces not being controlled sufficiently by governments. A lot of the inequality and the environmental damage that has been going on around the world is precisely being caused or exacerbated by governments taking too much of a backstep, letting corporations have too much power. And now we see governments coming in and trying to sort of beat up people that protest about this situation.
Mm. Is there much, Peter, that we can learn from protests in the past and the resistance of governments in the past in terms of what we're seeing today? I'm thinking of, you know, Prime Minister Billy Hughes tried twice to introduce conscription into Australia. He failed both times. Australia was deeply, deeply divided on this issue. People went to prison at the time who were involved in the protests. Seemingly it got up in the end because of the grassroots support opposing conscription. Is there anything that we can learn from those days?
Well, there's a lot we can learn from the successful and the unsuccessful attempts. I think part of it is building a coalition. In fact, a large part of any protest movement, any successful protest movement, is building a coalition, because it's going to start with a small group, almost invariably a small group of activists, of so-called radicals, whether they are radical or not is often open to question. But you've got to get out to other sectors of the population. Verity refers to the radical flank effect. Sometimes the radicals can lead the way, but you've got to bring in other people behind you who say, who can establish policies and institutions that will back up the you know, when progress is made. Mm. For example, I don't know what Bob feels about this, but I've been looking at the Committee of Inquiry into the National Estate into the 1970s, which was an important part in the early conservation movement. And the protest activists are obviously putting things on the agenda and raising the issue and making people think about it. But you can't follow through unless you bring in the respectable middle class matrons who think it's a good idea to preserve certain buildings or certain areas. Right. And then you also had Jack Mundy from a totally different section of the... that's how success is done, yeah. Building coalitions. Mm.
Committee of Inquiry.
Maybe Bob and then Verity.
Mm. Oh, sorry, Verity. That Committee of Inquiry came out of the destruction of Lake Pedder. Mm. And Brenda Heen, a devout Christian, died after a plane crash going to Canberra to write Save Lake Pedder in the skies over Parliament House here, after she'd received a death threat and the hangar had been interfered with and the emergency beacon taken out and hidden behind drums, and there was no adequate inquiry into that. And we've seen that gallantry of people whose heart is in it reaching out, and of course that on the shoulders of the campaigners for Lake Pedder, the Franklin was saved, but not until 1,500 people had been arrested and 500 sent to jail for peacefully protesting in the public forest on the banks of the Franklin River. And we're now seeing, of course, governments saying, well, we're going to make the penalties so draconian that people won't protest for social justice or the environment, but all they're doing is building the dam to the point where the protests, and on the climate emergency, the existential crisis that we human beings face with the extinction of our fellow species, is one that has to be faced. And the greater the protest, the earlier it will be faced. At the moment, it's foot on the accelerator of the destructive processes which have brought that about. But Greta Thunberg and the kids of Castlemaine, and then the mass protests around the planet, have enlivened us. And one of the reasons I feel happier in my old age than I ever have been before, having been through the 60s, is to see this resurgence again of public action, people getting out of their comfort zone to take action for a planet that we either bequeath the better for being here, or with mass human cruelty and destruction of the environment continue. We've got to take 11,000 scientists are appealing to us to address this existential crisis. The people know that, but the politicians don't, and they're simply saying we'll lock people up who want to protest about that. They will lose, but a lot of people are going to go to jail because of the direction being taken by governments in Australia and, as Verity says, around the world before that happens.
Mm. So I suppose the question then, Verity, is what makes for a successful protest? What are the ingredients for a successful protest? We're seeing, for example, right now, the Extinction Rebellion protesters, young people, impatient, angry, want climate change action. How can you see that potentially translating into something, a successful movement that will bring about political change?
Well, I think generally it helps if protest movements have appropriate targets. If you think of the tent embassy on the manicured lawns of Parliament House, the Freedom Riders taking on the locals in New South Wales country towns. But perhaps more spectacularly, the two women in 1965 in the Regatta Hotel in Brisbane, Merle Thornton and Roe Bogner.
Oh, I love this story. Yeah.
Yes, who chained themselves to the bar, pointing out that women weren't allowed in the front bars of hotels. They were obliged to buy drinks in the ladies' lounges where they were typically charged a lot more and they earned less. Zelda De Pirano, a few years later, chains herself to the railings of the Commonwealth offices in Melbourne, protesting against repeated failures of the Arbitration Commission to award equal pay for equal work. Perhaps a particularly good one is the Women's Action Committee in Melbourne went on a mass tram ride and insisted on only paying 75% of the tram fares because they only received 75% of the pay. So having good targets helps. But another very important factor is whether or not the support of the labour movement is there. Now, the matrons, the middle-class matrons of Hunters Hill in 1971 had found that all their lobbying and letter writing and so on was absolutely getting nowhere to save Kelly's Bush from being bulldozed to make way for luxury houses for the rich by a real estate company. So they contacted the New South Wales Builders Labourers Federation, who came out and heard the arguments. They insisted that the women call a public meeting in the area to show that there was widespread support for a ban on the destruction of Kelly's Bush. And sure enough, there was. And this is the origin of the famous Green Bans movement, when builders, labourers, for over several years, refused to work on environmentally damaging and socially irresponsible projects. It was powerful because it involved middle-class environmentalists and workers with power at the point of production who withdrew their labour. And that movement certainly changed the culture of town planning. It led to governments bringing in much better heritage protection laws, environmental protection laws. If you look at just some of the more concrete examples of what was saved, the rocks. Mm. Developers wanted to turn the rocks into concrete and glass skyscrapers, yeah. an extension of the central business district. It was only saved from a green ban. Millions of tourists go there each year. They certainly wouldn't have gone to see what the developers had in mind.
And what strikes me about all of the examples that you've quoted, Verity, is that all of them were achieved through peaceful protest. And I wonder whether that's a key part of successful protest, that it not turn violent, does violence turn off public support for protests?
Well, I mean, the Green Bans movement, actually, there was quite a bit of violence enacted against the protesters, and including Juanita Nielsen,
I was talking more about the actions of the protesters. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think, and Bob was talking too about how environmentalists have been the victims of violence and those people seeking to protect the built environment the same. But in terms of the protesters themselves, they are under great scrutiny by the media, aren't they, in terms of how they act in public protests?
Absolutely, and countless examples have shown that often the media plays an invidious role in that it often, even before the protests have started, gets across the message that there is going to be violence, and this sort of softens up public opinion to accept police going in and in fact starting the violence. Obviously, it's important for protests to be non-violent if they possibly can. It does discredit protests if there is violence, but we also know that often that violence is the fault of agents provocateurs, sent in by the powerful that are being protested against, to discredit the movement by picking up a stone and throwing it at a police horse or whatever. So there's a serious problem, this, in that often the protesters are actually innocent, but they are nonetheless seen as having been violent when they haven't been.
Pat, I'm interested in your perspective as someone who has, sure, marched in the streets, but perhaps more significantly, been in some very senior jobs in government and in the bureaucracy, CEO of ATSIC, a senior job in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, the Department of Health. These days you're seeking progress with Indigenous Health with Nacho. What have you learnt about getting outcomes via the processes of government versus what's achievable through people power? And perhaps bringing those two things together. Are there any lessons that perhaps you can draw from that experience?
Well, I think, my commitment to getting resources out to Aboriginal community-controlled services had always driven me in my public service career. So I always listened to my people.
Mm-hmm.
I had didn't have all the resources to respond to every request, but we tried to be as fair. I tried to be as fair as possible.
But learning how government works too, and the processes of government, and how to
get
things.
Well, it's come in handy for the latest. Not quite a number, but for the latest exercise. So what I did we're getting nowhere with the government on closing the gap. You would have all heard about the failure of them to meet the targets or even be on track, targets that they set. To achieve lowering equity in life expectancy and children's education and all these things. And so failure was, really very clear. So they went through a whole process, the government, of conducting consultations on a refresh, and we found it totally unsatisfactory. 12 months, waste of time, was going to be more business as usual. So we said, no way. So we wrote to the premiers and the prime minister and the chief ministers, got a meeting with Scott Morrison, and he got it. I have to credit him for that. He got it. He said, so we can't do it without you. I said, no, you can't. And so he agreed to a formal partnership with us at COAG and led that and got it over the table at the COAG council meeting in December last year. By March, we had a national partnership agreement signed by the Coalition of Aboriginal Peaks and every Australian government is now a signatory to that and committed to it.
Mm.
So this is a very different way of working.
Yeah.
And so I'm pleased. Look, it's not easy. We're doing a lot of the heavy lifting because we're the original thinkers in this. Government thinks it's business as usual. And so there's some really hard negotiations. And we expect that they've got to come good with the money because you can't do it, you can't do it without the resources. But we're prepared for that to be implemented over a 10-year time frame. Mm. So I'm hopeful that they stay true to their commitment to work in equal partnership, equal decision making, and that our views are respected and carried through.
Yeah. Now let's look at some campaigns that high-profile campaigns that perhaps didn't achieve the outcomes that were desired. The biggest protest I've ever been to was the protest against the Iraq war in Brisbane, Peter. 100,000 people or so marched in the streets of Brisbane. There were protests all over the country. Incredible protests. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people marching. The opinion polls tended to show, too, that the public was opposed to that war. Why did people power fail in that respect? Why did it fail to change the mind of John Howard?
I think John Howard was fairly committed, and he was also one of the most astute politicians of recent decades. The way he handled the Iraq commitment indicates, I think, that he learnt the lessons of the Vietnam War and the Vietnam protests. There were no conscripts in Iraq. In fact, at one stage, I can't remember just when it was, a former chief of the Defence Force raised the idea of bringing back some form of national service, not necessarily military. And when Howard was Prime Minister, and he killed that within, it didn't last 24 hours in the news cycle. He said that is definitely out. Mm. But getting back to Iraq, he sent a small force with a specific role which kept them fairly removed from the American military machine. So they had a separate role, quite a distinct one. And he went in and made it clear that they would go in fast and they would come out fast. There was an exit strategy, which there never was in Vietnam. So those troops were removed. So that those protests that you referred to, they failed, but who knows what would have happened if Australians had still been in... Some were sent back, actually, at a later time. But if they had been there for 6, 7, 8 years, suffering the sort of casualties that that Australians suffered in Vietnam, there'd be hundreds of thousands on the street.
It's fair to say, though, isn't it, that the protesters against that Iraq war are on the right side of history, given what we now know about the absence of weapons of mass destruction, given arguably what we knew at the time, actually, about the arguments about weapons of mass destruction. That would seem to be a case that those protesters look like they made a pretty reasonable call at the time, even if the government didn't support them.
I think they did, but the remarkable thing is that it was handled by the government in such a way that the Howard government did not pay the political cost compared to the Liberal country or coalition governments in the late 60s and early 70s.
Another protest I thought I'd bring up, Bob, that you might not be too happy for me to bring up. We last spoke in Brisbane when you were on your way up north to the Stop Adani convoy. We now know how that ended. There was a backlash against Labor in Queensland, not that you were there to do Labor's bidding for them. There were, though, criticisms that the protesters were not respectful of the locals and their concerns around jobs and financial security and so on. With the benefit of hindsight, was the Stop Adani convoy a mistake?
No, absolutely not. And you cannot get home under the bed, because you've got people like Rene Valaris at the Courier-Mail running a jihad against decent Australians making a point. The fact is that we've seen the follow-on from that was that Labor unfortunately went to an election not offering Australians a strong alternative. I think if Bill Shorten had said, as Bob Hawke did back in 1983, I will stop the Adani mine, not the dam, but I will stop the Adani mine, he could be Prime Minister now. But the campaign against Adani goes on. The majority of Australians are opposed to that mine, and we're now at the situation where the Wangaran Jangalingu people, and Adrian Burugaba in particular, have been evicted from their own land because Adani has been given it through a process. So here we are in 2019 Australia, where Indigenous people are off their own land, and they said interfering outsiders. Adani is running this from India. And I remember very well Joe Jerkey-Peterson coming down during the dam campaign and saying, oh, you've got to build that dam, you've got to build that dam. But here we've got the Courier-Mail and the Murdoch media, which owns 80% of the papers coming out in Queensland, saying interfering other Australians should have no say in Queensland. What rubbish. You know, you stand up for what is right, and I'll be going back up to the Adani mine in the coming times to stand with Wangan and Jungalingo people, and all those Australians who believe we should be not mining more coal, putting it into the atmosphere, and threatening the future of life on this planet, simply so that Adani can go from being number two richest Indian to number one billionaire by exploiting the planet. That's not on. And we have, if we don't, as Australians, make a stand against the multiple wrongs of the Adani mine, who will?
Verity, we look at some of the big campaigns in recent times. It is worth being reminded that there is significant opposition from the media, from powerful interest groups. The fossil fuel industry obviously sees action against climate change as an existential threat to them. We looked at the movement for same-sex marriage, opposed strongly by the church. Indigenous land rights and native title, opposed by the mining industry. In order to win what you want to win out of your protest, you have to defeat some pretty powerful institutional forces, don't you?
Absolutely, and I think the Adani and the reporting of the Adani convoy is a good example of how protesters are very much at the mercy of media and also media narratives. For decades now, corporations and backed up by the media have been running this story about how Greenies don't care about workers and their jobs. In fact, the Greens have fairly well thought out and clearly articulated policies around just transition and the importance of ensuring that workers displaced from the closing down of coal mining or coal-fired power stations are assisted to be employed just as well in alternative forms of employment. But that message was totally lost in the media reporting of the Adani cavalcade, because the media presented it as yet another example of Greenies not caring about workers' jobs and livelihoods. I think that you might have anticipated that and perhaps tried to work out ways of getting around that better. Certainly, it's another...
I'm open to any suggestions.
Yes, that's right. I mean, you were sort of almost on a hiding for nothing. The forestry industry is another example of where the media has brought about this myth of tree huggers driving forestry workers out of a job. In fact, 98% of job losses in the forestry industry in the last 20 years are due to restructuring to the forestry companies, cost-cutting with, you know, increased mechanisation and so on. Mm. And it's very handy for the Forest Industries Association employers to pretend that it's the fault of Greenies and to perpetuate that myth of Greenies and workers being at odds with each other, whereas in fact they have so much in common because there's no jobs on a dead planet.
Whereas in fact in Tasmania, absolutely. But you know, it's the jobs myth being used by corporations who are so good at shedding jobs as they automate, and the profit bottom line rests on them getting rid of jobs. Mm. And in the case of Tasmania, after all these multiple protests over decades, it's the natural environment which employs 35 times as many jobs as the loggers, logging companies. It's Greens create jobs.
I want to take some questions from the floor in just a minute. Just wanted to ask you though, Pat, you look at a couple of the... Let's look at, say, the reconciliation marches in 2000. Once again, enormous numbers of Australians who marched in good faith and in good spirit for reconciliation. As Matt was saying before, I took 6 months off recently and spent most of that time living in Berlin, in Germany. And if I came away from that sabbatical with one message, it was the benefit that comes from making peace with your past and being honest about your past. You know, we've had the reconciliation marches and then much more recently the statement from the heart in Uluru. What is it, in spite of all of the protests, that's stopping us from making that move forward? Do you?
You'd have to ask the white fellas.
From a black fella perspective, what do you think?
Well, I think a lack of understanding of the real history, and you know, and people saying, you know, people don't like to hear the negative statistics. You know, they really don't. And they say, well, I'm struggling too, you know. Well, we know that, but not to the extent that our people are. And so we try to, you know, get people to understand it's broader for us. The Uluru Statement from the Heart is an appeal to every Australian. And every Australian should really read it, because it's not a demand, it's a plea to walk with us, you know. And we've been doing this for decades, really. You know, you might sort of, you know, reflect on an occasional time when there's been a bit of aggressiveness between white and black, but generally our people have been very peaceful. Very peaceful. And, you know, when there's been plenty of opportunity to not be. But it's not our way, you know. So in terms of where we go, really, white Australians have to ask themselves, when are they going to face up to the true shared history of this country and recognise that we were here for, you know, 60,000 years before the British colonised us, and the impacts of colonisation have just been devastating. So, you know, I mean, I keep hope for my own people, you know, and I talk to a lot of Australians. But, you know, I want people to work a bit harder to get to understand our situation themselves.
Sure. Okay, we have a little bit of time left, and it would be good to get some questions from the floor. We've got about a little bit less than 15 minutes before we have to wrap it. Let me just say, questions are much more preferable than statements, and brevity would be much appreciated in your questions, please.
Yes, I understand that. Bob Brown, I note what you say about the Adani protest, and I think Bill Shorten, by trying to walk both sides of the barbed wire fence, certainly didn't help things. But going back to 2009, the Greens effectively torpedoed the ALP's efforts to bring in some sort of climate legislation on the basis that it wasn't very good. But the net result is that 10 years later, we've got no climate legislation, and had they been allowed to pass theirs, it could have been amended and fixed and adjusted as time went by. So what have you got to say about that? Are the Greens just too pure?
Thanks for that question. It was extraordinarily weak. But after Labor and Liberal came to an agreement on it, and then the Liberals dropped out, Penny Wong flew to Hobart and asked Christine Milne and I to take it up, and we did, and we had some amendments. And she said, but I will not take any amendments back to Prime Minister Rudd. And he, by the way, had the option of a double dissolution election. I think he'd have done well, and the Greens would have done well in those circumstances, but he backed off from that. When came Julia Gillard's turn, she did negotiate properly with the Greens. We did get a much better piece of legislation, and some of that in terms of funding renewable energy and so on goes on now, despite the worst efforts of Tony Abbott, who would have wiped out the Rudd legislation and left nothing at all. But Julia Gillard's proposals, worked out with myself and Christine Milne, have even withstood the destructiveness of Tony Abbott's short period, mercifully short period as Prime Minister. Sometimes a compromise, politics is the art of compromise, but sometimes you just have to turn down proposals that have no real effect in when you're looking at a problem that needs to be properly addressed.
Okay, another question.
It seems like Australians have a relatively low concept of what's a big protest in assessing what can be achieved with big protests, with the Iraq example from 2003. I mean, at the moment in Chile, there have been repeated protests of 1 million people in a country of less than 20 million people, and they had big periods of protests in 2011, 2006 as well. We actually don't know what might happen in Australia if we had repeated protests of 1 million people, and so I wonder if we're really not really testing the limits of protest.
And how do you get 1 million people out onto the streets in Australia too? I suppose it's another question.
Well, it's coming. Simply because the destructiveness of the climate emergency. We have, by the way, had 300,000 people out quite recently on this climate emergency, led by the young people who can see what's coming down in their lifetimes. But we're one of the wealthiest countries on earth. We're just too comfortable by half. And it's very hard to get out of the comfort zone, to step off the footpath, to say, no, I'm going to defend the future. I'm going to stand with young people. I'm not going to leave them to a 20% hit on their income. I'm not going to leave, as Professor Garnaut says, a Murray-Darling Basin that's going to lose 90% of its food productivity by the end of this century. Look at the drought at the moment. I'm not going to simply allow more coal mines and coal seam gas and destruction of forests feeding a process which is going to leave the next generation depauperate and fighting itself on a global scale. So really, our nation, yes, is challenged, but the best way to change this is not through millions of people on the street, it's through the ballot box. And in May 2019, 90% of people voted for candidates standing for more coal mines. Come on, Australia, we've got to change that. And when we do change at the ballot box, as happened with the Franklin campaign way back there, and happened with Gough Whitlam in the wake of the Vietnam moratorium, the country can change course and move into a much more an era in which it's much more content with its own soul.
Can I just ask a quick supplementary question to you, Verity, about has the golden age of street marching and public protest passed us by? I mean, are we now looking at a time where activism is going to happen more and more at an organised level, online, linking up communities of interest virtually, or do you still think that people marching in the street can make the difference that they made all those decades ago?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that tried and tested old forms of protest are enduring. They're being supplemented rather than supplanted by other forms of protest. But some of the forms of protest that people think are sort of novel, in fact, aren't. The Extinction Rebellion owe a lot to the traditions of non-violent direct action and satyagraha popularised by Gandhi. Even the anti-corporate movements, grotesque effigies, making of great puppets and so on, actually dates back to medieval times when peasants would, you know, have the head of the Lord of the Manor on a pike and parade that through the street. So it's, you know, I mean, things just keep going around and coming around, and I think online mobilisation is more a way of organising other forms of protest rather than a form of protest in itself.
Okay, can we take another question? Thanks.
Sorry, I'm up here at the moment.
Hi.
Maybe you're next. I'd like to bring it to a contemporary position, and that's Dr. Edwards in relation to the War Memorial at the moment. There seems to be a very groundswell objection to the fact that they're going to spend almost $500 million, which includes the knocking down of Anzac Hall. I'm just wondering, do you think that, or what sort of protest or action do you think could work in relation to this? Because the groundswell that I'm reading is that, no, it's not popular at all. In fact, there's a lot of the people that I've mentioned it to sort of have said, well, we could do a lot more for the vets rather than the memorial itself. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah. I've taken, well, I've not taken any public position on that. I've have great reservations about it because I was certainly very surprised that Anzac Hall, for example, would be taken down so soon after it was constructed. And I can think of a lot of other places or a lot of worthy causes that could benefit from that sort of money. I think the case needs to be made. I see the Prime Minister's just come out and defended it again. There was a collective letter by a number of people, including, I think, three former directors of the War Memorial protesting about it. So I think, well, as I say, you need to build a coalition. I think one has to get a number of people who would not normally be associated with this sort of protest to say that they are against it. That's the only way you're going to overturn a decision which had bipartisan support, I may say, before the last election. The leader of the opposition expressed his support for it. Sorry?
Sadly, yes.
Yeah. So you'd need to build a much broader groundswell of support from, including from veterans organisations, to have, you have to have, as Pat quite rightly said, you have to have a strategy, and you have to work out how that strategy is going to mobilise all sorts of different constituencies, apart from those whose opposition to a particular proposal may be taken as inevitable.
How much better if that $500 million was spent on a truth house where the post-invasion history of first Australians was laid on show for all Australians who wanted to go and see, that we come to grips. You were talking earlier on about how well the Germans do it, that we came to grips with our own history and had such a place that we could see that, and I think all Australians would be much better off, and so would the War Memorial.
And to the lady in the front.
Back to Adani, now I say I'm not very well versed in government workings or legislation, but how is it possible for the Queensland government to just extinguish native title in order for Adani to proceed and set up this situation with Adrian Baragaba and not being able to be on his own land?
Well, there was some federal and government involvement too, but they simply gave the Crown land title across to Adani through legislative process, and the efforts in the courts to defend that land have left Baragaba bankrupt and Adani making potentially more billions. It's a part of the Australian inability to come to the defence of Indigenous people who are often offered incentives by corporations to go against their own feelings on country, when we should be, as Pat was saying, addressing not just closing the gap, but the right of individual peoples to determine what happens on their land, and not have governments, weak spine governments, caving into the next corporation that comes in and says, I'm going to give you this if you overrule these Indigenous people.
Well, I just can't believe that we're having another coal mine, when we should be moving to, better energy sources. But the one thing I do say about the young climate activists is thank God, but that shouldn't allow those of us who are older to be complacent. We should be out there with them because, but I'm so glad that they are coming through, and I look forward to the reforms that they'll make, not just for climate, for our environment, overall throughout the world. But I reckon that, you know, they'll have a much better understanding of issues like social justice and fairness and so on. So I look forward to them, you know, maturing and bringing their experience forward.
Yes, converting their anger perhaps into action. I've got young kids myself, actually in their early 20s, and there's a lot of frustration and anger there and concern about the future, I can tell you. Look, it's been a terrific discussion, as they always are here at the National Museum, as we take a look at parts of our past and reflect on the present. Look, please put your hands together for our fantastic panel of guests. As they say on Insiders, over to you, Matt.
Thanks, Paul. And please put your hands together for Paul Buckley. You know, in the course of the discussion tonight, I was struck by how much, in a sense, one is moved by seeing protest or indeed political action of any kind that springs from a deep personal inquiry about a moral or ethical question that affects us, and connecting that to a broader collective sense of our common good. And it seems to me that the discussion tonight has touched on this as the essential character of political life, which is really about how we organise ourselves and make decisions in our common interest. That there is a connection both between the personal realm of consideration, reflection, what we believe is right, whatever that might be, and thinking about the benefits, the circumstances of the collective, our society, our people. And for that, I thank not just Paul Buckley, but also our panellists, Bob Brown, Pat Turner, Verity Bergman, and Peter Edwards, once again. Thank you. This panel will be broadcast on ABCRN's Big Ideas program in the weeks to come. And if you enjoyed tonight's discussion, keep an eye on our website for news of next year's program, when we plan to host more absorbing discussion that reflects on defining moments in our history. Indeed, you should contribute, if you're encouraged to, by what you see there, to this debate, which is ongoing about the important defining moments in our nation's past. And thank you all for your attendance and good humour tonight. Good night.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.